I'll read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, and I'll keep it fairly short, so anyone who wants can ask questions. This is a verse from the 9th chapter, the most confidential knowledge. This is considered to be the center of the Bhagavad Gita. It's 18 chapters, actually. And the middle six are considered to be the most confidential. And this one in particular is called the most confidential knowledge. The verse reads, Raja Vidya Rajaguyam Pavitramidam Uttamam Pratyaksha Vagamam Thalam Shushukam Kartam Avyayam. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. Sometimes Krishna consciousness is categorized as a religion, but in fact, it's not really a religion in the traditional sense of religion. Religion is something which changes. People change their denominations from Hindu to Muslim to Christian to Jew and so on. So it's a changing name, a changing thing, religion. What Krishna consciousness is, among other things, a science, it's a cultural movement, and it's what we call Sanatana Dharma, or that principle which does not change. Sanatan is eternal. Dharma means beauty or quality. Quality meaning the natural or the constitutional position of a human being. That's called Sanatan Dharma. In a material object like fire, the Dharma would be heat, or in ice it would be cold. These are the characteristics. A human being's Sanatana Dharma is to render service. Wherever we look, we see human beings are rendering service, irrespective of their faith or their position in life. Even one who isn't employed is serving himself, at least he's serving his stomach, or he may be serving his audience or his constituency. Everyone is engaged in some form of service. That's the nature of human beings everywhere we look. Someone's engaged in service. So Krishna consciousness is the study of the science of the human being's consciousness and his original constitutional quality or nature. Our nature is just that, it's to serve. We may not like to serve our boss, but we like to serve our wife or our husband or our child or our friend or our lover. We naturally always want to serve someone, even from the very beginning. We have a distinct impetus to render some service to our parents. As we grow older, we want to do the same with a friend. As we go through life, we want to do the same with our families. And some want to render service to their countries, to some cause, or to the greater human society, the world as a whole. So Krishna consciousness is the study of this nature. And therefore it is called the king of education, because it studies the most fundamental nature. And that is called Sanatana Dharma, that thing which does not change. Everything around us is changing. Our own bodies, our own minds, the whole world around us is changing. The trees, the beasts, the air, the water. We see changes all around us as we go through our life. So the purpose of understanding Sanatana Dharma is to understand those principles which do not change, the constant factors in life. Many people are searching for the essence of life, and that is why Krishna consciousness is also called the secret of secrets, because it's very simple, and yet it's very difficult to apprehend the essence of truth. Because the first principle is to understand that as these bodies change and they grow old, irrespective of the faith or the race or the nationality, there's something which does not change. And that is our essential being or the soul or Atma. So the first and most difficult thing to to understand and even more difficult to realize, to be fully conscious of at all times, is that this changing body is not my real identity. It's not my real self. It's but a covering, just like the coat or the shirt or the sweater. It will change, whereas the body underneath doesn't change. So beneath the body, there is another more constant being, and that is the soul. And as this body grows old or changes, or we change our mental attitudes, the soul remains the same. And it is very powerful energy. When scientists discovered there was a type of energy within the atom they never knew about, even though it was extremely minute, they called it atomic energy, they were astonished. The whole world was astonished at how powerful these little tiny bits of energy could be, ultimately making a big bomb that could destroy millions of lives or create energy for other reasons, for heating and lighting and so on. So the soul is also very small, like the atomic energy, but it's very, very powerful again, like atomic energy, but even more powerful. It's more powerful because it's more enduring. Even these radioactive ingredients, they have a period of life, and then their energy dissipates. So the soul, unlike that, is even more subtle, more difficult to apprehend, and more powerful, because it doesn't dissipate. It's an eternal factor, or an eternal form of energy. We see the sun survive so many changes in the seasons. The sun is simply shining, whether it's winter or summer. And even modern scientists will tell us, astronomers, that many of these planets will have a lifetime, then they cease to exist. The sun endures much longer. So the soul, or the Atma, it endures even the death experience. Therefore, we come to the point of understanding the eternity of the soul and the temporality of the body. So this is the first principle, to live in the consciousness that I'm not actually the material body, but the living soul within that body. And even though we can understand it from a purely intellectual point of view, that I'm not really the body, I'm not my hand or my foot or my leg or my head or my ear. I have an ear, I have a hand, I have a leg. So if we aggregate those things, then if I'm not my leg, body, and all those other parts, then I can't be the aggregate, the body. So I must be this. I must be something else. I'm the energy which keeps that body going. And the proof of that is that when this body is no more animate, no matter how beautiful, attractive a body may be, as soon as the life is gone, then that very same body, with the very same face, very same eyes, very same complexion, immediately at the time of death, that most beautiful body, instead of being very attractive, becomes very revolting. The same look, the same complexion, the same features, the same shape, but in one instant it changes from completely attractive to completely revolting. It's not because the forms have changed, or the features have changed, or the color of the hair or skin has changed, because at the moment of death there's no visible difference in those things. But the life force, the soul, the Atma, that has left, that is no longer present, there's no life in the body. And therefore, the conclusion is that it is the life which actually made that body beautiful. The thing that we couldn't even see, the little spark of soul, that the very powerful energy that animated that body, that is what was so attractive in making that body so beautiful. So this is a simple logical understanding of why we cannot actually say we are these bodies, but we're something more fundamental, more basic than these bodies. That's the spiritual spark, or the Atma. So, according to Vedic philosophy, when the soul survives the death experience, it continues, and it takes another body. It forms another body around it. It actually travels to another place, maybe in this city or this country, maybe in this planet, maybe in another planet, maybe in another universe. It can travel faster than any known means of travel in the world. And according to the type of consciousness that is accumulated, it will take birth. This is also explained in the Bhagavad Gita, Yam Yam Vapi Smaram Bhavam. According to its accumulated, what we call karma, it takes a birth in any one of 8,400,000 different types of forms of bodily existence, human, plant, aquatic, higher than human, and so on. So knowing this brings us to what is described here, a susukyam, very happy, to a very happy state. At least it's the beginning of a very happy state, because when we're actually aware that these things that we often have to suffer by being in this material body, such as birth and death and disease and old age, they're very difficult. When we understand that we actually survive these and we survive the death experience and we have another opportunity to continue, then this is the beginning of at least, if not happiness, at least being aloof from the miseries that we all experience, at least understanding that these things are temporary and that we can survive them. So these are the real problems of life, that we have to die, that we have to become diseased, we have to grow old. And according to Vedic philosophy, we have to again be born somewhere, somehow. And that birth experience is actually a very painful one. And it may not even be human birth. So it's also a very risky situation, birth. We don't know where that birth is going to be, what kind of an entity. So to understand this, immediately there's a sense of relief that these bodily, including mental sufferings that we all have to experience from time to time, are things that we can actually transcend through our understanding our eternal nature. So this knowledge is called the secret of all secrets. Now there are many problems that beset us in the material world. Someone was telling me there was a big article in one of the papers today, I think it was the Weekend Mail or the Sunday Mail, about the environment. People are very upset, increasingly so, that the water they drink and the air that they breathe and the food that they eat is becoming more and more polluted with all sorts of chemicals and radioactivity, germs, and waste products from industry and various other byproducts of this age. And, of course, this is very well known. I suppose it's as known here as it is in America. The water table, it must be the same in all of the European countries, is gradually becoming very polluted by these various wastes that are seeping into the ground over the years, percolating down into the water that we drink. And I was reading one account that even the bottled water that we think is very safe has very high levels of toxicity, sometimes even higher than the tap water we drink, because it's taken from wells and streams, underground and so on, that are being polluted from this seepage. This is a scientific test. It's on record. Even very well-known brands. So wherever we try to get water, out of the tap or out of the bottle, it contains these things called nitrosamines and other poisons that are very dangerous. They're said to cause cancer. The air, the very air we breathe, where can we go to get clean air? We can't go to another planet, but the whole air, the whole atmosphere is polluted by waste, industrial waste, acid rain, and so on. I read another account that the 90% of the forests in Holland are dying from this acid rain. It's a very, very large amount of poison that almost all the forests are actually dying. So there are, and this is true in of the foods, especially the meat products. They're injected with hundreds and hundreds of chemicals after they're made ready for market and of course into the animal before he's killed. So the food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, it's a very worrisome sort of thing. And in the Bhagavad, in the, pardon me, the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's described that this is one of the concomitant factors of the age. There is a lot of pollution, a lot of quarrel, a lot of difficulty, and above all, a lot of anxiety. This is explained in the very beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But people are characterized by anxiety in this age, this particular age. They are known as Manda Sumanda, and their behavior is very substandard as a result of this anxiety, and as just a general result of the nature of the age in which we live. So, how to untangle all these various difficulties? There's the threat of war as well, which plagues human society. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's explained that although we try to make many solutions to these problems, the problems become even greater than the original. The solutions, I should say, become even greater than the original problems. Now, an example of that is the automobile. I come from the country that invented the automobile. And they were very, very thrilled at the idea that they could get from A to B in just a fraction of the time. But then a problem came about that they couldn't produce roads fast enough to facilitate this new invention. So finally, the roads were made better and better. And after some time, the number of accidents increased. So then safety laws were passed. And the next problem occurred that there was a great deal of pollution going into the air. So they made devices to put on these cars. But they were more expensive. Cars became more expensive with the smog pollution devices. And eventually, despite all these pollution devices, I lived in Los Angeles for about 6 years, 7 or 8 years maybe. The air is very difficult to breathe. Sometimes when you're driving down the highway, tears stream out of your eyes. And if you ever fly into that city in an airplane on a clear day, you'll see a big black cloud. Not a white cloud, but a black cloud hanging over that city. You can barely see more than 2 or 3 miles. Not even the nicest, sunniest day in the city. So the automobile was a great invention, but the solutions to the problems it created became greater than the original problem. In other words, it's easier to get about on a... We'd be better off if we just had bicycles or horses and buggies. So that is the nature of Kali Yuga. So these problems become an inextricable network. It becomes very difficult to try to sort them out one by one, to try to find a solution for this one, a solution for that one. Nonetheless, as Prabhupada used to say, Krishna consciousness is a solution. That there is also a concern that there is a lack of resources. We're running out of oil, and we're running out of all these things, running out of good air, running out of good consciousness, running out of morality. We're going to run out of water and food. All these things are worrying everybody, dwindling resources. But anyone who actually studies the Vedic literature and Krishna consciousness can understand that the real shortage and the only shortage in the world is Krishna consciousness, or lack of understanding what Sanatana Dharma is and what our real position is and how to act according to that realization. Because as soon as that understanding is there, then all of these problems, which are like a big knot, become unraveled one by one without any difficult, expensive, or long-term endeavors that don't even succeed in the end. Because our natural position is to understand this. This is our natural, original, happy, constitutional position. When we identify with the body, we identify with our community and our nation. Therefore, there's the threat of war, that this tract of land on this side of that line belongs to me and I have to defend it to the death. Well, that's actually artificial, because everything belongs to God or Krishna. It's a very simple fact. And because that very simple fact has been overlooked, because God is no longer thought to be alive or meaningful or part of our lives, there's a threat of war, of annihilation of practically the whole human race. And because we are intemperate in our habits of acquisition and living, industry has grown so big and powerful that it is able to pollute the air and the waters without any restraint, despite so many laws that are being passed year after year. Someone told me this article in the Standard today, the Daily Mail, was complaining how the government wasn't doing anything about all this industry. It couldn't. It was a helpless, useless government because they weren't doing anything to stop the pollution of the seas and the air and so on. Well, they've passed many laws, and many politicians are campaigning. Many movements are existing to stop all these things. But because the consciousness isn't there in the industry and in the government, the consciousness is to acquire more than we need. It's to acquire excess, much, much more than we need. There's more bombs than we need, even to fight a simple little war. There's more cosmetics than we need. So many superfluous alcoholic cigarettes, so many things. Billions of acres are growing ingredients for liquor and tobacco products. And many people are going hungry. So this is due to improper consciousness or improper understanding of our real identity. Real consciousness is to understand that I only need a limited amount. And if everyone could just understand that simple thing, gradually all of these problems would unravel. In Vedic culture, which is the culture that Krishna consciousness comes from, those who were, this was extant in India 5,000 years ago, a culture in which those who were affluent and wealthy, they gave profusely in charity. They never became so bloated with goods and money that everything became out of proportion and that the millions were starving at the expense of the rich. But they gave profusely in charity because they had a common understanding that God is the ultimate proprietor of everything. So there was no scarcity and no anxiety about employment or getting enough to eat, supporting a family. So this simple understanding that God is the supreme proprietor immediately solves a whole array, myriad problems are taken care of. So this is the first and foremost activity of the human being, to understand Sanatana Dharma, not to go about everything in a roundabout or indirect or misdirected way, the way we're going. Because as the Bhagavatam states, these solutions simply create more problems. And the solutions to those problems in turn create more problems, ad infinitum. As explained here, this knowledge gives direct perception of the self by realization. This is not understood simply by book learning or intellectualizing that I am not this body. It may appear very obvious, but by realization means that we actually come to this realization that I'm actually not this body. So much so that even at the time of death, a devotee who's fixed in this consciousness doesn't become fearful. He becomes very peaceful because he has a sense of his next, of his future, of his destiny. And therefore he becomes free from fear altogether, because all of the fears that we experience are ultimately due to the ultimate fact that we have to die or leave this body. But one who understands who I am by realization, not just by intellectualizing, but actually realizes, yes, I'm not this body, he becomes very peaceful and satisfied. And even when there is disease and pain and difficulty and threatening and stressful situations, he's peaceful. There's another very important verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, that Krishna is the ultimate enjoyer, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, he's the supreme proprietor, which we discussed, he owns everything, all the lands, all the businesses, all the food, everything in the world. And Bhoktaram Jagatam Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam, that he is the friend, the ultimate and best friend of all living beings. And Gyatvamam Shantim Richchiti, anyone who understands these things, these three things, immediately becomes peaceful, attains peace from the pangs of material misery. Sometimes we're frustrated in our interpersonal relations. It's very common. Most marriages end up in a divorce at some point. Of course, people get remarried. But this was not the case 100 years ago or 200 or 300 years ago. It's the nature of the age. It's very difficult for any kind of human relationships to endure and to grow properly. So to understand that Suhridam Sarvabhutanam, that Krishna is the supreme friend, and how he's the supreme friend, how he actually acts from within as the supersoul and from without as the spiritual master, spiritual guide. Again, we feel very satisfied because we have our most perfect intimate relationship with another being, a person. Krishna's a person. And when this is at the center of our desire to love another, then all of our relationships become purified and endure, or can be understood better, and we can act from the spiritual platform in our relationships with everybody else. So another very simple thing, to understand how Krishna is acting with us as the supreme friend, brings us to understand how relationships work, how to understand how the mind, the senses, the emotions are all working. So when it is described that this is the king of knowledge, or the secret of all secrets, it's not simply that there's a God, Krishna, who we love. Of course, that's also true on one level. But the philosophy is so multifaceted. The explanation of Krishna's various qualities and capabilities is so exhaustive that books filling this room wouldn't even touch but a tiny, minute fraction, infinitesimal fraction of all the qualities of Krishna and his activities, and all the ways in which he interacts with his devotees, with all the other living entities in the material and spiritual worlds. These things would fill universes of literature, literally. We have published about 80 or 90 different books, and these are just scratching the surface. Of course, many of these have knowledge in very concentrated form, like the Bhagavad Gita. But just to give an idea how vast this knowledge is, it covers every possible field of knowledge, every discipline. So this is the basis of spiritual perfection, to understand who Krishna is, how he interacts or comes into this material world. And Krishna, the other part of this verse I mentioned, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, is that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. Our gravest difficulty is that we, from the time we're born, we try to enjoy. Just like the little children, they're sometimes described as, I think the Freudian term is orally fixated. They're always trying to put something in their mouth, to bite it, to suck on it, to lick it, to swallow it. They're just constantly doing that because we're pleasure-seeking beings. As we grow older, we seek pleasure in more sophisticated ways, which virtually have no limit because the human mind is very complex among living entities. While an animal is basically trying to eat, sleep, mate, and have sex, the human being enjoys music, enjoys so many different types of aesthetics. He enjoys more on a more subtle level. And his desires to enjoy are infinite. A human being can enjoy infinitely different things, as many things as we can think of and beyond and more. So we are always seeking that. But as we experience pleasures, we see that they aren't unlimited. In our youth, we may see that there's an unlimited amount of pleasure out there. But as we experience more and more, we begin to sense that there is a beginning and an end to pleasure. Every pleasure has a beginning and it has an end. And in old age, of course, it's very difficult because the senses are weaker. All of the senses are weaker, so we can't experience pleasure with the same intensity. So Krishna is described as Govinda. Govinda means he who gives pleasure to the living beings. Krishna is actually the source of pleasure. So when it is said, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, his pleasure is unending. So the pleasure a devotee of Govinda experiences is a spiritual pleasure, that given directly by Govinda. That pleasure doesn't fade, doesn't dwindle. It's not something that we have to keep changing, going from one type of pleasure to another. But it's fixed. It's constant within the heart. So a devotee, even though he may be living very simply, without affluence, without a lot of material pleasures, he feels completely happy. Susukyam. He feels joyful, in fact. Not just happy, but actually blissful, joyful. even though he may be living in a simple shack by the river. That's extreme, but he can live in a very simple way, and yet he feels completely happy. Because he knows that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, and he's enjoying as Krishna's servant. We were talking about service, how service is the Sanatana Dharma. His life is given to serving, not his senses, but to Krishna. And therefore, he's getting a constant return, a constant and greater reciprocation. The law of diminishing returns is present in our quest for pleasure. But with Krishna, that law is contravened, and pleasure increases without limit. That's the difference between spirit and matter. Spirit is unlimited, matter is limited and temporary. Spirit is eternal and ever-increasing, matter is temporary and comes into being for some time, grows, maintains. The law of diminishing returns is present in our quest for pleasure. But with Krishna, that law is contravened, and pleasure increases without limit. That's the difference between spirit and matter. Spirit is unlimited, matter is limited and temporary. Spirit is eternal and ever-increasing, matter is temporary, and comes into being for some time, grows, maintains, sometimes has some offspring, dwindles, and then ceases to be. So this pleasure is permanent, and it survives every religion, every denomination, to develop love for God. So love for God in its purest and highest state is that which is beyond any religion, but it is the essence of our being, to actually come to the state of being immersed, infused with love of God at every moment. And such a person sees God everywhere, sees Krishna everywhere he looks, just as we sometimes experience in the material world, lovers thinking of the beloved everywhere, seeing that form everywhere. So a lover of Krishna or a devotee of Krishna sees Krishna in everything, everywhere, at all times. And therefore his propensity to love is never frustrated, even in old age, even at the time of death, and feels always very happy. So that is called the perfection of religion. It's not simply to enter a church, mosque, synagogue, or temple and offer prayers. That's not religion. Religion is to obtain perfection, meditation upon God or Krishna at every moment, and to see everything through the eyes of Krishna's being, or Krishna's instruction, or Krishna's words. That's called Shastra Chaksu, to see everything through the eyes of purified knowledge. So this is called then a purest knowledge. Purest knowledge. Pure meaning that our sufferings are due to contamination within the heart, contamination within the mind. So the whole process of Krishna consciousness is one of cleansing the heart, to eradicate all impurity from the heart and mind. This is called pure knowledge and understanding of who I am. And in this state, one becomes happy and gradually unravels all the problems of life. So that's our purpose, is to unravel all the problems of life through chanting Krishna's names and purifying ourselves through the yogic process of Krishna consciousness. Any questions?
sounds very appealing to ask for all to do this, but some are going to be able to throw themselves in wholeheartedly, those rare people, and other people like myself are going to have to take the time and trying to absorb the mind in Krishna consciousness. So what, speak of the people who say come here for the first time tonight, for them what could they do? I mean, how could they serve Krishna without kind of jeopardizing their career, throwing up their family, you know, losing everything? How would that, what could they do?
The process of devotional service is meant for everyone. It's not meant for just a few who make a lifetime commitment to live a life of austerity. In fact, very simple service to Krishna, even offering a flower to Krishna, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, is something that Krishna accepts with great love and devotion. So if there is a sense of love of Krishna, or even love for, or a favorable feeling for his devotees, that is where devotional service or love of God begins. It doesn't begin in the temple. It doesn't even begin in the heart of the purified yogi. There's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam which says, where Krishna says, that I don't live in the heart of the yogi, nor do I live in my own planet, but I'm to be found where my holy name is being chanted. So, particularly in this age, anyone who even utters Krishna, or chants a little bit of Krishna consciousness, of the Hare Krishna mantra, that person's spiritual life and spiritual understanding begins at that point. And it's not recommended, in fact, that one should make a radical or drastic change in lifestyle. That's not the method. When Lord Chaitanya, who propagated Krishna consciousness all over India, was active, he went from village to village. And just by seeing him, by rendering a little service to him, by thinking favorably about him, many people perfected their lives. So the point is that the process is a gradual one. It's not that Krishna can be seen in a flash of light and then we have realization. When we speak of realization, we speak of a very scientific, a very gradual process. And even those who live in the temple, though they may live the life of a monk and ascetic, they may be many lifetimes away, as we say, from devotional service. Because we cannot tell by the outward appearance. If someone makes a great offering with love and devotion of a little leaf or a flower, Krishna appreciates that more than a very affluent offering of a building or a lot of money if the person is not so sincere in his heart. So love of Krishna is there in the heart of everyone. It's not limited to those who look a certain way. Just as in wood there is the potency for it to burst into flame when the conditions are right, because it contains certain chemicals, but when there's heat it will become fire. So within everyone, within the heart of everyone, Mamai Vamso Jivaloke, we're all part and parcel of Krishna, is this nature to serve Krishna. So on whatever level that devotional service takes place, that is immediately accepted by Krishna, and Krishna reciprocates many times over. Krishna is more eager to accept our service than we are to serve him. Mm-hmm. So even the smallest service, the most seemingly insignificant service, if it's done with a feeling of love for Krishna, Krishna is waiting for that. Just as a wayward or prodigal son or daughter is welcomed when he or she comes back home, because the parent is always pining away for the lost child, but the child may not be very much thinking about the parent. But Krishna is always longing for the living being to turn to him with love and devotion. So however that comes, in whatever tiny beginning, Krishna is immensely pleased and reciprocates. And that's when the whole process of Krishna consciousness begins. In fact, our congregation is very, very large now, larger than the number living within our communities, which is a sign, because so many thousands and thousands of people, literally, they've committed themselves. This is my spiritual path, Krishna consciousness. Even though they're not undergoing great austerities, but they've made a commitment. So that's the beginning. That's the beginning of devotional service. And Krishna appreciates that. And it's step by step, it begins to grow, just like a little seed in the heart. If we water it every day, that seed will gradually grow and fructify. And it doesn't matter whether we're working 9 to 5 or we're living in a temple. The same seeds, the same heart, the same Krishna, growing the same way. So we shouldn't feel second rate or that Krishna is unapproachable because we can't live the rigorous lifestyle of the monks and the full-time preachers and teachers of Krishna consciousness.
I've been coming here for about a year now, and what you just said, you know, it's true. And when you first start off chanting and you know, reading a bit of Krishna consciousness, it's wonderful. But as I've been here a year now, you know, all the anxieties that you talk about, you know, I see all of it. You know, I don't know what that's called. That isn't really my idea. But you know, when you're living in society, like we're still, I find it hard to cope a lot with what I see. So many anxieties, unbelievable. I mean, how do you actually put, how do you deal with that? You know, sometimes I find it difficult.
You find it easier than before you started chanting?
Well, I find life easier.
Well, do you find it easier to cope with the anxieties?
With chanting, yeah. You know, since I've been coming here, it's hard to describe. In one way I do, in one way I don't, you know, because I can see these things. And you feel like when you see, you know, what's going on, you feel like you want to, it's fine. You can't do something about it, I suppose.
Right.
But, you know, I'm on nobody, so it's hard to hold on to it, sort of thing.
Yeah, but obviously you've kept chanting because personally you find it's improved. There's some benefit for you.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that's there with everyone, whether one is a full-time committed devotee. There's the same anomalies exist because we're living in the material world, after all, and we haven't changed it. So one anxiety is that I want to change the world. I want everything bad to go away. But of course, as you mentioned, we have to start with ourselves. It's doing something for me. The nature of the material world is that there must be anxiety. And we read in the Bhagavatam and how even some of Krishna's most intimate devotees, his own parents, his intimate friends, were put into great difficulty. There was the war that Arjuna had to fight. The 5 Pandava brothers were put into exile. They lost their kingdom. Queen Kunti's sons were all engaged in battle. Draupadi's sons were slain. It goes on and on. And these examples are there for us to understand that within the material world there will always be, as long as we are within the purview of the marginal energy which we live and we see birth, death, disease and old age, we'll experience it, we'll see it. But our purpose is to become more and more purified so that we can become aloof from it. Not that we can ignore it or pretend it's not there, but that we can understand its nature. This is described in the Bhagavad Gita, that matra sparsha stukontayas, sukosha sukadukata, that these things come just like the seasons, the dualities of the material world, hot and cold. So we learn to take out an umbrella when it's raining outside. But gradually we learn the spiritual process by which to cope with the dualities of the material world. For one thing, if we understand they're there and we know they're coming, we can fortify ourselves. If we chant, we can keep our anxieties. Just like you said, you've experienced a better ability to cope with anxiety. We can learn to keep the level of anxiety down. We're going to get sick sometime. We're going to get diseased. But the process of Krishna consciousness prepares us because we know they're going to come. And we know, as Tamsa Tiksha Sabharata, as the Bhagavad Gita says, we have to, a wise man learns how to tolerate these things without being disturbed. So the key is learning tolerance. As we become spiritually strong, we learn how to be tolerant with our own minds, with the difficulties that other living beings cause us, and with the fortune or misfortune that may befall us. So tolerance is actually described in the Nectar of Devotion as being one of the measures of strength of a person and person's development. So the more we become spiritually strong, the more we're able to tolerate.
Do we actually come to honor ourselves first, or to honor other people?
Pardon?
Do we become to honor ourselves first, or to honor other people?
Well, both. Because to tolerate our own minds, and to tolerate the minds of others, we're getting it from within and without. The mind is considered to be a dangerous enemy, according to the Bhagavad Gita. So one who is Krishna conscious, it said, can make that very same mind the best friend. So the first thing is to control our own mind. And when we're able to do that, we can tolerate the difficulties that others give us, because our mind is controlled, explained in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. When the mind becomes peaceful, it is because we're becoming tolerant. And we understand that the material nature will always be challenging and difficult. Sometimes our growth in Krishna consciousness is compared to curing a patient, diseased patient. Treatment is the Hare Krishna mantra, devotional service, prasadam, association with devotees. So in hospital, patients appear in various states of cure. Those, when they're completely cured, are released from the hospital. So similarly, the conditioned soul, when we're completely pure, we're actually released from the material energy. We get a spiritual body, and there's no anxiety. But step by step, according to how much of the cure we've taken or are able to absorb and put to work, our anxiety level will decrease, and our tolerance will increase, and our ability to see spiritually will increase. It's like a medicine. We have to keep taking it. Then we get more spiritually pure. We come back to more and more to our original condition. And just to carry that metaphor a step further, when we take our administered medicine, there's usually some other prescription that goes along with it. A certain diet, for example, or you need a certain amount of sleep, you have to eat a certain way. So along with the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, there's other prescriptions about how to live, how to eat, and so on. And the more we're able to put all these things together, the stronger we'll become spiritually.
When we come here, we're all visiting, and it's always very clear what we should be doing. I mean, we go back into the real world. It's not always very easy.
As soon as we walk out this door, the whole world's going to cave in on us.
And often, you know, devotees only come together once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the rest of the time. So how can the devotee increase this?
Well, this is the whole crux of the matter, isn't it? That how to keep it. So, of course, there are many things that are described in the Bhagavad Gita, how we can do this. We're manmana bhava madbhaka madhyaji mam namaskara. We're reading this verse this morning. That we should always, whenever we can, we should always try to think of Krishna. We should offer obeisances. We should offer our homage. We should always try to think of ourselves as Krishna's devotee. And of course, the more we can associate, the better it's going to be, the more we can associate with devotees. But the whole process is to train the mind to never forget Krishna, even after we walk out of here or we get into some very untoward situation, something that would completely scatter our thoughts. At that time, we should train our minds to think of Krishna. When we're doing something or something happens to us that takes us farther away from Krishna than anything else, if we train ourselves to think of Krishna at that time, that will help us to remember Krishna at every moment. So this is the real serious point. This is the real essence of how do we train ourselves to meditate on Krishna. It's a form of meditation, actually, Krishna consciousness. And one who is perfect doesn't forget Krishna, even for one second, even in dreams. Pure devotee always thinks of Krishna, doesn't dream of anything but Krishna. So the most important thing to remember to do is to chant, first of all. Because the more we are able to hear the Hare Krishna mantra, the more it will force our mind to think of Krishna. We hear Krishna's name, we'll think of Krishna. We hear Krishna's name, we'll remember Krishna. We hear Krishna's name, we'll remember devotees. we hear Krishna's name, we'll remember Krishna's teaching in the books. If we hear Krishna's name, we'll remember what prasadam tastes like. If we hear Krishna's name, we'll remember what a wonderful house this is. What a wonderful person John and all of you are. This is how we become Krishna conscious, because we are in one sense made up of all the relationships that we have. And if we think, we chant Krishna, we think Krishna, we think Krishna's devotees. It just automatically happens. We say Krishna, we think Krishna's devotees. So therefore, when we're driving, when we're walking, when we're rising, when we're retiring, there's so much time. If you ever sit down and analyze how many, not just minutes, but hours in a day, we could be chanting. We're not doing something that requires a lot of great concentration. We actually, we're not only chanting, but concentrating on the sound vibration, which is the essence of the whole Krishna consciousness movement. It's really amazing. If you sit down and just try it sometime. Just keep a little diary, what you did from the time you got up to the time you went to bed, one day. You'll find so much time that you can be becoming Krishna conscious just by chanting. So you can take it with you. Just requires training. Just requires hearing that you have to do it.
Is it that you have to force yourself in the beginning?
Yeah.
Because there's the feeling that, you know, maybe this is just some kind of strange, hypnotic, sort of brainwashing, humdrum thing. And it might even be dangerous.
Injurious to your health.
Yeah.
It's like we have to force ourselves to get up in the morning. Nobody wants to get up in the morning. It's a very painful, unnatural experience. But force ourselves up. But if we don't get up, we're going to be much worse, much more miserable than if we did get up.
Some of us are locks, in other words.
Some of us are what?
Some of us are locks. We can get up in the morning. Yeah. Some of us are owls.
Right.
Stay awake at night.
Right. It's a difficult thing, nonetheless. Just to hear that alarm clock, it's very painful. I mean, I've trained myself to get up in the morning early, but I don't like the sound of that alarm clock. And that first few seconds, it's a painful thing. I'm sorry, it's painful. I have to admit it. But the point is that once we've done it, once we've just done that thing, we've forced myself to get up, then I'm going to get into my normal activity. I'm going to live instead of being half dead, which is what sleep is. So spiritual life is like that. It's like awakening from the sleep state. The sleep state is analogous to the state we're in right now, this contaminated material state. And the awakened state is analogous to the spiritual state. So Krishna consciousness is basically awakening. It's going to be painful because in the course of obtaining love for Krishna, we're going to forego certain things that we're used to, certain pleasures. So there is some difficulty. It's described as being poison in the beginning, but sweet nectar in the end. Whereas the material pleasures are sweet nectar in the beginning and poison in the end. So there is. Discipline is required. It's required. And someone may characterize it as being dangerous and brainwashing and all that because it's painful. But they're not going to get anywhere in spiritual life. They'll be their own worst enemy because they won't experience the pleasure of spiritual life.
Yeah, because actually when you're sort of going along, I've noticed that when you're going along in ordinary life and just doing what you want to do, it doesn't seem to matter. Nothing seems to, well, hardly affect. But I found that when you come to spiritual life, it seems to change.
Mm.
Some reason, it seems to be almost more painful in a way.
The outlook changes. In other words, you're seeing the
difference. It's like you're coming up against something, waking up.
Yeah, so you're seeing what the difficulties of the material nature are from the perspective of one who has risen above it to some extent. In other words, when we're in the material nature and when our whole consciousness is based upon material thinking, we're part of that. We're part of the problem, as they say. And as soon as we become part of the solution, I hate to be trite, but it's kind of a nice phrase. As soon as we become part of the solution, then we can see that all of this goings-on that is of material reaction, action and reaction, is somewhat pointless. Not that it's totally pointless. There's a reason for everything. But we see so much of it as pointless in as much as it's not bringing us to a higher level of understanding. Just like I was explaining before, there's an exhaust control device to stop the exhaust. But it doesn't. It doesn't really stop it, because there are more cars produced and the volume of the pollution just increases. So that's kind of a pointless thing. I mean, it's necessary, but at the same time, it's pointless. And we're seeing that if a more intelligent solution from a different perspective would be achieved, then this problem could be solved.
So the goods up by canal.
There's so many things.
Beautiful.
Things like that. So the folly of so much of what happens in material energy becomes more poignant to us, becomes clear. Why are these two people having an argument here? Why? What's the point? Is it really that important? Krishna is their best friend. They have a best friend. Because they thought they were best friends, and now they're not, then the whole world is falling apart. So to see things from the spiritual perspective, we can understand that so much of the problems that are there are pointless, really pointless problems, because we're thinking we're the body, or the community, or the whatever we are on our job. We're identifying so much with that that just like when a person gets in a car accident, he gets so upset. You just, you know, people will curse and they'll cry and they'll be in anxiety for days because their car got smashed.
Or even kill.
Huh?
Or even kill.
Yeah. Yeah, they sometimes will do that. They'll become very angry. They'll kill someone who ran into their car. The car is not them. It's a car that they own. So a devotee, one who is on the path of Krishna consciousness, gradually realizes that this, even this body and this mind are but a vehicle that surrounds my inner being. So whatever happens to me, it's not going to interfere with my essential existence. Someone may cause me anxiety, but I don't even own this body. It's just a temporary vehicle that I'm driving around in for a few years, and then it's going to be gone, just like a car. So he becomes peaceful. He's not all these insults or difficulties and diseases. They're seen to be not something that are really affecting my essential being. And they're temporary. He knows it's just here today, gone tomorrow. So that's why you see great souls, they're always happy. They're always in a state of bliss. Because the soul by nature is always happy. It's always joyful. So devotional service, as we were reading, that's joyfully performed. When devotees are chanting, it's because the soul is coming out. The impurities are being cleared away and this natural joy is being released. It's being given its full opportunity to express itself. Any other questions?
How can a devotee not become discouraged then? With, you know, maybe having to deal with so many heavy anarthas and seemingly sometimes to be compelled just by the nature of his condition into thoughts and even actions that he knows are really detrimental to him. Once he knows, has his knowledge, it can be very painful for an aspirant when he feels himself almost compelled by his condition to act and think in ways which are detrimental to his ultimate self. So how can you not become very discouraged by that?
What do you mean, compelled to act in ways detrimental?
Just like sometimes devotees who are having just even sort of external attachments to, you know, wife, home, TV, bread, you know, things mm-hmm. that you know really basically you don't really need, but you kind of still
yeah.
caught up.
Well, they may be detrimental in one sense. At least outwardly detrimental, but our business isn't it to transform those things which are material into spiritual energy, or to engage at least everything. So the bread, the need to have to eat, that's transformed into energy which is used for Krishna. The family, that's energy. It's so many more opportunities to serve Krishna, to give one another more energy and opportunity and enthusiasm to serve Krishna. So it's not that material acquisitions are detrimental by nature. It's how we are able to engage and use everything in Krishna service. Because ultimately, the devotee understands it doesn't belong to me. It's not my bread. It's not my house, it's not my family. Now, John, I'm sure he understands this is Krishna's house, so it's a beautiful house. And it's even more beautiful because it's being used for Krishna. It's not dragging him down into material existence or forcing him to do something against his nature. He's using the whole beautiful house for Krishna, and then it becomes transcendental world. So the devotee's art, the Bhakti Yoga is called an art. Prabhupada used to call it the art of transforming matter into spirit. We learn how to do that. To take every, even the adversities, even those things which are openly adverse to Krishna consciousness, ultimately those things can even be made into a spiritual effort or engage in devotional service. Here's one example. When devotees were brought into a court case, they were accused of brainwashing. Someone said they brainwashed me, and they were accused in a court of law of brainwashing. So the result of that case was that a judge said that the Krishna consciousness movement was an ancient faith that going back thousands of years in India, and it became very famous. It was given great attention in the media. And so the initial adversity became a great benefit for the whole movement. It actually happened. That it was given a kind of blessing and a sanction. The public accepted the movement on a higher level. So these are some instances where devotees were able to change an adverse situation into a Krishna conscious a victory, as it were. Oh, sure, yeah, please.
How long are you in this country for?
28th of September.
How long have you been here?
I just came about it.